Welcome back. We have rearranged the chairs here on the stage, and hopefully you have found either your chair or someone else's from before the break. I wanted to, before I introduce our speakers today, I wanted to read a few brief passages from a recent issue of The Economist magazine, which I think helps to set the context for the last 5 years and for today. On the morning of September 12, 2001, Americans woke up to a changed country. They had seen the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center reduced to rubble, the Pentagon aflame, and a field in Pennsylvania transformed into a graveyard. Almost 3,000 people had been killed and twice as many injured in the bloodiest day on American soil since the Battle of Antietam in 1862. The attacks brought an end to the holiday from history that followed the fall of the Soviet Union. They also brought an abrupt end to America's sense of invulnerability. For all its military might and oceanic moats, the country was wide open to attack from fanatics living in caves in Afghanistan. On September 11th, Mr. Bush concluded that America was at war. That day, too, he stated that he would make no distinction between terrorists and those who harbored them. And America would not simply treat symptoms, it would tackle the causes of Islamic terrorism. The doctrine drew on two contradictory beliefs, that America was mighty enough to reorder the world and that it was vulnerable to still worse attacks. And as I say, I think these passages set a useful context for this morning's discussion. We are mighty, yet we are vulnerable. At least that was the sense on September 12th. How have these sentiments changed over the past 5 years, and how might they change further over the next 5 or 10 or 15 years? Before I introduce our panel, I wanted to take just a minute to acknowledge some of the work of my colleagues, recent work of my colleagues here at Cato, several of whom have really worked yeoman's work on issues of civil liberties and counterterrorism, including Robert Levy, who's testified and written on the National Security Agency's surveillance program, Jim Harper, who explores how a free society balances privacy concerns with effective strategies for combating terrorism, Gene Healy, who has done terrific work on the expansion of executive power since 9/11. And I'll make a special note for Tim Lynch, who's the director of Cato Institute's Project on Criminal Justice. Tim co-authored with Gene Healy the paper Power Surge, The Constitutional Record of George W. Bush, published earlier this year. And he has just published, just 2 days ago, the paper Double Speak and the War on Terrorism, a concise and absolutely first-rate study of how language has been used and abused since 9/11. I recommend it to you all. It's available outside, and I do recommend it. Today's panel is tasked with exploring both the conduct of the U.S. war on terrorism since 9/11 and to suggest some steps for fighting terrorism in the months and years ahead. You already know Professor Robert Pape. Thank you, Dr. Pape, for your presentation today. I'm sure there will be some further discussion of your work from the panel discussion and in the audience Q&A. I want to introduce our other distinguished panelists. First, Dana Priest covers the intelligence world and national security issues for The Washington Post. In April 2006, Priest was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for beat reporting for her work covering U.S. intelligence agencies. Copies of these articles are available as handout outside. Ms. Priest was also a finalist for the Pulitzer in a second category in national reporting as part of the Post team that investigated abuses in Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison. In 2004, her book, The Mission, Waging War and Keeping Peace with America's Military, was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in general nonfiction. Priest has worked for the Post for 19 years. She's written extensively about intelligence lapses before the attacks of September 11th, about the failure of pre-war intelligence in Iraq, about the covert war against suspected terrorists, and, of course, the CIA's previously secret detention facilities, which we've already mentioned. I read Dana's articles when these were first published, of course, and then I read them again over the last few days, and they provide an invaluable picture into the United States counterterrorism efforts since 9/11. Just this past Wednesday, President Bush publicly acknowledged for the first time the existence of the CIA's so-called black sites. According to senior administration officials quoted in this morning's Post, the revelations of the secret CIA prisons marked a turning point in the internal debates raging within the Bush administration over the morality and the practicality of the detainee policy. Before moving to the intelligence beat, Dana was the post-Pentagon correspondent and then wrote about the military as an investigative reporter. She's traveled widely with the U.S. military all over the world, Asia, Africa, and South America, and reported from Iraq, Afghanistan, Bosnia, and Kosovo. She holds a bachelor's degree in political science from the University of California at Santa Cruz. Next to speak will be Andrew Kohut, director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. Kohut comments frequently on the meaning and interpretation of public opinion polls. In recent national elections, he served as a public opinion consultant and analyst for National Public Radio. He appears on television news programs, including The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. He's written widely about public opinion for leading newspapers and magazines. And he's co-authored four books, including most recently America Against the World, How We Are Different and Why We Are Disliked with Bruce Stokes. His work with the Pew Research Center, he was president of the Gallup Organization from 1979 to 1989. In 1989, he founded Princeton Survey Research Associates, an attitude and opinion research firm specializing in media, politics, and public policy studies. He was the founding director of surveys for the Times Mirror Center from 1990 to 1992 and was named its director in 1993. He was president of American Association of Public Opinion Research and of the National Council of Public Polls. He's a member of the Market Research Council and the Council on Foreign Relations. He received his AB degree from Seton Hall University in 1964 and studied graduate sociology at Rutgers, the State University, from 1964 to 1966. Next is Flint Leverett, senior fellow and director of the Global Energy Initiative in the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation. Most recently, Dr. Leverett was a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution Sabin Center for Middle East Policy. Prior to that, he had a distinguished career in government, serving as senior director for Middle East Affairs on the National Security Council, Middle East expert on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, and senior analyst at the CIA. He's the author of Inheriting Syria, Bashar's Trial by Fire, a study of politics and policymaking in Syria that also offers recommendations for U.S. policy toward this critical country. He's published many articles on strategic implications of the energy market, about China's energy-driven engagement in the Middle East, Middle Eastern regional security, and other issues in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Financial Times, the Los Angeles Times, and a number of other publications. He is also the author of an outstanding cover story in this month's American Prospect, The War Makers, which is also available outside the auditorium. In addition to his public work, Dr. Leverett has appeared on a wide range of news and public affairs programs, including CNN, C-SPAN, PBS, and The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. He holds a PhD in politics from Princeton University and is a life member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Next is Rand Beers, currently the president of the National Security Network, a network of experts seeking to foster discussion of progressive national security ideas around the country. He's also an adjunct lecturer on terrorism at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. He most recently worked as the national security advisor for the Kerry Edwards campaign. He began his career as a Marine officer and rifle company commander in Vietnam, 1964 to 1968. He entered the Foreign Service in 1971 and transferred to the Civil Service in 1983. During his career, he served in the State Department's Bureau of Politico-Military Affairs as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Regional Affairs, focusing on the Middle East and the Persian Gulf. He was Assistant Secretary of State for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, 1998 to 2002. He also served in four positions on the NSC staff at the White House during four administrations. His functions included Director for Counterterrorism and Counter-Narcotics, Director for Peacekeeping, and Senior Director for Intelligence Programs. His final government position was Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Combating Terrorists on the Terrorism on the NSC staff from 2002 to 2003. He resigned in March 2003 and retired in April before joining the Kerry campaign in May 2003. And with that, Dana Priest.
Thank you. Well, I'm so glad to be here. It's my first time at Cato to speak, although I love their publications. And for some reason, I thought I'd have a little time to do this because journalists have nothing to do in the run-up to 9/11. So my notes are a little scattered. I thought I would take you inside the government's learning curve, if you will, on terrorism, and particularly the CIA. I could talk about special ops, too, but really what I've covered mainly for the last several years is the CIA's efforts on counterterrorism. And as you may or may not know, even though they were on to bin Laden and trying to hunt him and the al-Qaeda network, they really couldn't even conceive of the sort of skills and legal authorities and things they would need when it finally happened. And when it did, scurried quite quickly, but with great effort to try to put in place a new system that would answer the most basic question. Well, what do we do with someone? How do we catch someone? And then what do we do with them once we have them? And how are we going to get information from them? Things that are basic issues, but were not really anything anybody thought deeply about before that. And so on September 12th, when these things became an issue, and certainly in the months after that, when the initial Afghan campaign was underway and they had individuals in their control who they really thought knew about the other plots or potentially other plots, the tough issue started to come up right away, which is, where do we put these people? And if you thought that maybe they had the next plot in their mind or on paper somewhere, how far could you go? And who was even going to go that far with them? Because the CIA wasn't in the interrogation business on September 12th, and they actually didn't have interrogators. They quickly put together teams of polygraphers and psychiatrists who did the initial interrogation of high-value targets, a name that came about and took on a legal meaning. Within months, and certainly over the next year or so, a whole new legal, almost extrajudicial regime was built. And this is the one we know a lot more about now because I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out what it was, but it required new authorities, it required a presidential finding, it required memos to the field that tried to outline, you know, how far you could go, where you could put people, and where you would do that, which required a whole new set of much deeper relationships with foreign intelligence services, some of whom the U.S. government writ large would like to have nothing to do with before 9/11, but now found that they really needed to develop these relationships. So aside from the logistics of how you capture people, of what you do with them, where you put them, which were enormous issues, the question also came up, how can we develop better ties with the foreign partners? And so, of course, the CIA had always had foreign liaison service relationships. That goes without saying. But under Tenet, I think he was particularly good at this, they realized right away that their best weapon in their struggle to find terrorists were their foreign partners. So they set about trying to do that, created what was called the counterintelligence, the CTICs, the Joint Operations Centers, and spent a lot of money trying to set those up, sent people into the field to try to, and George Tenet in particular among them, hosted a lot of foreign intelligence leaders, and the whole effort here was to get people working side by side with CIA, who they sent out into the field to do that. In certain places, they created physical sites in which CIA could go out and vet people from foreign services, because, of course, one problem was how could you maintain operational security. And they created more than two dozen of these around the world in some of the countries that you would imagine, like Saudi Arabia, Jordan, which already had, of course, a very deep relationship, Indonesia, Yemen. And meanwhile, while this is going on, there is the military campaign, and most Americans probably focus on that as the main element of counterterrorism. But really, when you look at the high-value targets that have been captured and the 75% of the al-Qaeda network that's been dismantled, it's largely been dismantled by the CIA in partnership with their foreign allies. And I would say the vast majority of the people who have been identified and actually apprehended have been apprehended by foreign allies. So that relationship is hugely important. My favorite relationship in this is the U.S.-French relationship, because at the same time that the French were getting bashed about the head by Don Rumsfeld for not wanting to join the Iraq buildup, it turns out that the French relationship was among the most productive of any in Europe or around the world. And that, if you looked step back for a minute and say, well, why is that? It's very logical. The French had set up, French had been victims of terrorism for decades, and they had already set up counterterrorism courts that had special authorities that American courts don't have, and that many of the their European countries did not have. And they worked very closely with the French to apprehend terrorists in Europe. But even more interesting than that, the French agreed to sponsor what is, I think, still the one and only multinational counterterrorism base. It's in Paris. It's largely funded by the CIA, headed by a former French general. And one reason they did this was because the Germans had rules that wouldn't allow the two German main law enforcement agencies to share information with one another, and they had to find a workaround to that because there were a lot of people who were suspect in Germany, obviously the Hamburg cell. So the Germans couldn't share it directly with one another, but they could share it with the alliance base based in Paris, and through them they could do something about it, and ended up arresting, actually setting up a man named Christian Gargansky, who's turned out to be one of the most important terrorists in Europe. They lured him from Saudi Arabia, where he had been studying for half a year, set him up on an airplane. Unbeknownst to him, there was a CIA person and a Saudi intelligence person, and they landed, and the who should be waiting for him on the tarmac but the French and the American station chief, and off he went and remains today. So that's just one area of cooperation that's nothing like you would see above the surface, but this was happening below the surface. Within the CIA, there was a huge power shift away from the regional divisions, where if you were an upper management person, that's where you went, and many of the decisions were made, to this counterterrorism center, which was not a center that was the focus of a lot of prestige beforehand, but it became the place to be, and it organized many of the apprehensions, and even some of the most controversial ones, like Khalid Masri, the naturalized German citizen who was stopped in Macedonia and held for a long time without without a lot of reason. One other thing I wanted to mention before we moved on was, all of this was consciously done in secrecy. And obviously, a lot of those operations, it's obvious why that's so. But I would argue that, and as a journalist, you wouldn't be surprised that I would argue this, that the extent of the secrecy, there's been a backlash to that, not just among the press, but among the public, and that the government fundamentally didn't really realize, and I'm not sure still today does, how hard it is to keep a secret these days. And I'm not talking about people within the government who might help reporters, but here's my favorite example. You know the story about renditions and how, what do you do with someone who you capture in Indonesia who's Yemeni and you want him to be put away because you think he really is a bad guy, but there's no judicial system to try him. What you do if you're the CIA now is you help fly him to Yemen or to some other prison. Jordan hosts them, Morocco, Algeria, I believe. But you have to do it all in secret. So this is what happened, and this is how we got on to the initial idea that the CIA had this fleet of aircraft that were flying people like this around and then literally disappearing them, in the sense that they were nowhere to be found and they were on nobody's register. We got on to the notion by a reporter in Indonesia, one of our guys, who was talking to some airport workers, who had told him about a mysterious plane that was on the runway and a guy in shackles, and it was about 2:40 a.m. and that was reported. The tail number was reported, not by us but by an Indonesian newspaper, and it just looked very suspicious. Well, that was at 2:40 a.m. By 7:54 p.m. that same day, the bloggers were at it. They had picked up the ones that are reading Phoebus in the international press, they had picked this up, and within 13 minutes of, it was on this blog whose name I can't remember, but within 13 minutes of being posted, you had this exchange. This is kind of like Air America. and then you had some guy who, you know, put in the address of the tail number and found Premier Executive Transport Service. Boy, that sounds like a cover name. And then, of course, we come into it using our computers. I went up to Boston and pulled some public available records, and the thing gets, you know, they're dead-end trails all over the place, and the lights are going off. And within a month, because it did take us a while to do this, using publicly available records, we discovered a whole series of post office boxes in Northern Virginia. And among those post office boxes, there were 235 names of people who were supposed to be in their early 40s or to early 50s. And when you looked into their bios, which, again, we can do on publicly available records, they all got their Social Security numbers in 2002, and none of them had ever lived anywhere. So we took this schema to the CIA when we were trying to figure out what kind of story we would write and how much we'd actually put in the newspaper, and we didn't put the post office boxes, and we put none of the names in the paper. We came to them with this flow chart saying, look what we found. And the answer, and expecting, as we do, because we have a dialogue with the government when we find sensitive things, expecting some kind of dialogue. Well, you know, this part of it we really don't want you to publish because of X, Y, and Z. Instead, we just got a no comment, we can't help you. And because I had sources telling me what this all amounted to, we made the decision. We had to make the decision all on our own what was too sensitive to publish and what was important to publish. So I'll wind up by saying all along the way, in trying to describe these relationships, it never seemed to me that the secrecy and the unconventional legal interpretations were sustainable, and that if you were in a real fight that would take you 50 years, as some people are describing it, you needed to have a system that was sustainable, which means you needed to have political buy-in and some debate on what it was you were doing. And I think what the president did the other day in acknowledging this and throwing it back to Congress, a body who was never into debating this, no matter what they say, because they're hard questions. Now you will get, to a certain point, a debate, and hopefully we will, as a country, get to a point where we've created a system that we can support and will not be, subject to the whims of the next political group that is in power. So, thank you.
Thank you, Dana. Andy?
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, and I think Dana's comment about political buy-in is my cue to talk about public opinion and how the war on terror is going with the public. I'm going to talk about the American public. I could talk about the world public and the 50 nations survey, the 50 countries in which we've done surveys and 110,000 interviews. But I only have 12 minutes to discuss hits and misses, and I think I would spend most of that 12 minutes, or all of that 12 minutes, and then some, talking about global opinion about the war on terrorism. But let's focus on the United States and on the American public. And I think that if the objective was to have a confident, united public that was willing and disposed to take an assertive posture with respect to the war on terrorism, 5 years later, we're not doing so well. There's been a whole round of surveys conducted now on the fifth anniversary of the September 11th attacks, all asking similar questions. And they mostly show that the public believes that the ability of the terrorist to attack us is at least as greater or greater than it was on September 11th, 62% in our poll, similar numbers in other surveys. Just 1 in 3 in our survey say we're safer today than we were before September 11th. Most think that the administration has made some progress on dealing with terrorism. According to the New York Times CBS poll, it still is the Bush administration's strongest suit, its best card, the best, its best evaluation. But only 13% think they've made a great deal of progress in dealing with terrorism. While overall concern about terrorism is about as great as it was in the weeks and months following the war on the September 11th attacks, what the public has turned away, what we see is the public has turned away very dramatically from what its initial instincts and attitudes were right after those attacks. First, what we saw in October and November and of 2001 and even into 2002 was a spike, an increase in internationalism. We saw it both in our long-term indicators, and we saw in a specific question that we did with the Council on Foreign Relations in October of 2001, 62% said the best way to prevent terrorism in the future is for the United States to play an active role in world affairs. That's a remarkable response from this public, which has a very soft on internationalism characteristically. But over the course of these 5 years, we've seen those numbers reverse themselves. The long-term indicators that Gallup and Pew have been tracking since 1960s showed a spike in isolationism in 2004 that was comparable, or 2005, I'm sorry, that was comparable to what we saw in the mid-1970s after the war in Vietnam, and in the mid-1990s when the end of history was declared and Americans thought they had no problems overseas. There was a very dramatic set of numbers on this in the CBS New York Times poll that was conducted this summer at the time of the war in Lebanon. That poll repeated a question that was conducted by CBS in the summer of 2002. In that survey, their respondents were split 46-48% as to whether the U.S. should take the lead in solving global problems. By 2006, their respondents were voting against the United States taking a proactive position, taking the lead in dealing with global problems by a margin of 31-59%. Quite a reversal, very consistent with what we found. This particular poll, which was taken at the time of the war in Lebanon, found that just 33% of the people that they questioned thought it was the United States' responsibility to try to resolve that crisis. No fewer than 58% said this was not the United States' business. We were back again. We are back again now where we were at various points in modern history when the public wants to turn away from international affairs. But what's strikingly different about this time is we are under the public feels under great threat, yet feels this sense of wariness. The shift, I think, reflects disillusionment, discouragement, and fatigue with the war in Iraq. The war in Iraq has also led to a reversal of another opinion about how to deal with terrorism. In 2002, by a 48-29% majority, the American public told us that the best way dealing with the war on terrorism was by increasing America's military presence around the world. Now we have a margin in the poll that we repeated this month of 45-32% saying the best thing we can do is to decrease our presence around the world. We see the same trend manifest with respect to specific measures. The poll that we conducted after the September 11th attacks in 2002 found a majority saying that they supported, a 58% majority saying that they supported using military forces, military strikes against countries that were building nuclear facilities. Today, that number has shrunk to just 41%. In short, the war in Iraq has spent down much of the capital amongst the public for dealing militarily with the problem of terrorism. The only proactive measure that gets more support now than we saw in 2002 was the percentage of Americans saying that it's putting high priority on energy independence. That is a more prevalent, more popular view, but all of the military options get far less support in this poll and just about every other poll I've seen. One of the other unfortunate consequences of of Iraq is it has divided us. Partisanship is now much more apparent in public attitudes toward the war on terrorism than it was when it than it was in much of two, all of two, the rest of 2001 and all of 2002. Republicans and Democrats differ widely on what the role of the United States should be in the world and over the potential use of force. Finally, the one murky, hard-to-read set of questions is how the public feels with respect to the trade-offs with regard to civil liberties in dealing with the war on terrorism. Most Americans continue to say that they believe they will have to make some sacrifices in with respect to civil liberties for the sake of the war on terrorism. That number is about 68%, almost as high as it was in right after the attacks. And most think that the Bush administration is striking the right balance between protecting civil liberties and waging the war on terrorism. But the public is divided over the warrantless wiretaps. They are divided over holding prisoners in Guantanamo without trials. And there's a real partisan deep division about many of the specific measures with respect to civil liberty, with respect that threaten traditional American civil liberties for the sake of the war on terrorism. There hasn't been much backlash, as far as I can see, on this, because basically Americans are more concerned that the government is not doing enough to deal with the war on, to thwart the terrorist threat than are concerned that they themselves are their own civil liberties are being threatened. For the most part, Americans don't feel that the civil liberty squeeze really affects them. They don't feel threat, even though when confronted with these individual situations and individual issues, you do get a fair amount of division of opinion and a fair amount of opposition, as Dana pointed out, to some of these programs. And I think I'll leave it there.
Great. Thank you very much. Flint Leverett.
All right. Thank you very much, Chris. It is a very much a pleasure to be on this panel. Chris asked me to take a shot at looking at the question of how well we're doing at the war on terror, not so much in terms of popular standing, as Andy just talked about, but more in a strategic sense. And I think to state my conclusions up front, it's not even a close call for me. 5 years after 9/11, the United States is losing the war on terror. The Sunni Islamist terror threat, as Bob Pape, particularly the threat of suicide terrorism, as Bob Pape demonstrated so persuasively in his remarks, has gotten worse since September 11. Not better. In the course of fighting our war on terror, we have done significant damage to other foreign policy interests, particularly in the Middle East. The president and his supporters like to make an argument that, well, America has to be safer. We haven't had an attack in the United States since September 11, and that must be because of our strategy of, as the president puts it, fighting them over there rather than waiting until they come here. I think Bob Pape's assessment of the Norwegian document demonstrated this is utter nonsense as an analysis of why there has not been a terrorist strike in the United States since September 11. I acknowledge measures have been put in place that make it harder for terrorists to operate in the United States, and that's all to the good. But the most important reason why there hasn't been a terrorist strike since 9/11 is because the terrorists are pursuing a strategy in which striking at the American homeland is not a priority in the near to medium term. jihadists have made a calculated, strategic, and tactical judgment that the best way for them to pursue their agenda in the near to medium term is by going after targets in theater and going after targets that will impact governments allied to the United States. And they will come back at us when they determine that they have stripped us of our allies and weakened our position sufficiently in the Middle East that we will be less capable of responding, and they can do even more damage to us by attacking us here. Have no illusions about that. They haven't attacked us here because they've made a strategic calculation in the near to medium term that that doesn't serve their agenda. But also have no illusion that they will be back at us at some point when they determine that coming back at us is going to have maximum impact in terms of their ability to pursue their goals. If this record of tactical and strategic misjudgments and mistakes were not enough to make me despair, I'm even more disappointed in the seeming inability of Democrats on any kind of organized and sustained basis to mount a serious critique of the way that the administration has conducted the war on terror. Yes, Democrats will say, yeah, the Iraq War wasn't carried out very well, wasn't planned right for the post-conflict period, made a lot of stupid mistakes in doing it. But only now are Democrats who supported the decision to go to war in Iraq in some cases willing to consider, well, maybe that was a mistake. And other parts of the administration's approach for fighting the war on terror, I think, have received very little sustained critique from Democrats or from others in the American body politic. And we have yet, I think, to have a serious national debate about what is our strategy for fighting the war on terror. And unless we get that right, we're going to keep losing the war on terror. I think that Bob Pape's work, first of all, it is a paradigm of social science that matters. I think every graduate student in political science, international relations, should memorize his book. I'm teaching at MIT this fall, and I've certainly assigned it to my students. But I also think every executive branch policymaker, every intelligence analyst, every member of Congress ought to be obliged to memorize that book. In his work, he lays out in very persuasive, very clear terms, I think, a couple of strategically very important points. First, that suicide terrorists, as much as we, you know, despise their tactics, and as much as we don't like them, in the end, they are not madmen. They are people using what, in their calculations, are instrumentally rational tactics to pursue a political agenda. They have what they perceive to be serious grievances, and their agenda is to get those grievances addressed and they have made certain judgments about the tactics that are most likely to get democratic societies to do what the jihadists want them to do. The second point that I think flows from Bob's work is that unless, as part of the war on terror, we are prepared in some way to take that political agenda of the jihadists seriously and to address it in ways that are consistent with the broad range of American foreign policy and strategic interests, we are not going to stop suicide terrorism. We are not going to win the war on terror unless we do that. Our strategy since 9/11 has gone almost completely in a diametrically opposed direction, both in terms of the assessment that gives rise to the strategy and the strategy itself, from the kind of strategy I think you'd follow if you took Bob Pape's work seriously. I think at a tactical level, if I can couch it in those terms, the war on terror has been unfocused. We had a chance early on in Afghanistan to deal what I think would have been a fatal blow to Al-Qaeda. There's been a lot of discussion about the failure to commit American troops at the Battle of Tora Bora in December of 2001. Even more striking to me, shortly after I took up my position at the White House at the beginning of 2002, there was a decision made to take out of Afghanistan the special forces elements and the CIA paramilitary cadres that were spearheading the campaign on the ground to round up Al-Qaeda. These were guys with a unique skill set, you know, serious operational abilities combined with language skills in things like Arabic and Pashto. But if you were going to go to war on Iraq, in Iraq on a certain timetable, you had to pull these guys out of Afghanistan, give them time to reconstitute, and put them back in theater in time for them to do their work to prepare the battlefield in Iraq. And so in February 2002, the decision was made to pull these guys out of Afghanistan. That is why when that spring, when snows melted, mountain passes became accessible, Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and others were able to flee Afghanistan, take up sanctuary in Waziristan in Pakistan. It's why another group of senior al-Qaeda figures was able to go the other direction into Iran. It's because we didn't have the right people on the ground to capture and kill them. It's that simple. But I think beyond those kinds of tactical mistakes, we've also really been operating in the wrong strategic framework. In the American Prospect cover story Chris was nice enough to plug, I make a point that, you know, more than 30 years ago, Henry Kissinger defined a paradigm for U.S. policy in the Middle East that it should aim at marginalizing radicals and empowering moderates. Well, in the 5 years since September 11, the Bush administration has turned Kissinger on his head. We have policy that has ended up empowering radicals and putting moderates under strain in the Middle East. Iraq is an important piece of that. Our decision to go in the first place, the ham-handed way in which we've managed the occupation since then, all of that certainly contributes. But we've made other decisions, all in the name of fighting the war on terror, which have only made this worse. We have refused to pursue serious, strategically grounded diplomacy with state sponsors of terror like Iran and Syria, even though we've had ample opportunities and openings to do that during the last 5 years. We have refused to deal seriously with the Palestinian issue, even though we know that whether we like it or not, whether we think it's a rational position or not, this is the core political conflict in this part of the world. It is the, if I can use, borrow a phrase from Shibli Telhami, it is the prism of pain through which Arabs and Muslims look at us. And by taking these positions in the name of the war on terror, we've not only undermined our own interests in the region, we've also made Israel's security and standing in the region decline over the last 5 years. And then on top of that, the administration embraces the credo of democratization and transformational diplomacy in the region. Even though, as Bob points out, there isn't a shred of evidence to indicate that democratization in Arab countries, Muslim countries, does anything to reduce the incidence of terrorism or support for terrorism. And there's ample evidence from places like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, other places in the region, that by pushing too early for a resort to more open electoral processes, you are only going to empower people who are more anti-American and more supportive of radical Islamist agendas than incumbent regimes. I think it is very much in our interest as part of the war on terror and for a lot of other reasons to be pushing on things like economic reform in the Middle East. I think it's very much in our interest to be pushing on issues, broadly lump them together under human rights. But democratization in this context is not just not going to achieve anything, it's going to make things worse. So my summary judgment is that by any reasonable measure, level of threat, level of capabilities of radical jihadists out there to do us harm, our overall standing in the Middle East, which is, after all, ground zero for the war on terror, the degree of support for radical Islamist agendas, including suicide terrorism, all of those things, we're losing. And we will continue to lose unless we are prepared to rethink our strategy for this war and pursue policies that are rooted in an accurate assessment and understanding of on-the-ground reality. And as far as that goes, I think Bob Pape has made a magnificent contribution to the possibility of a public debate on these issues, and I can only hope that more people will read him and take him seriously. Thank you.
Thank you, Flynn. Rand Beers.
Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to be here. And Flynn, I'm going to come at the same questions in a slightly different fashion, but thank you for that wonderful presentation. I'm going to ask four questions and then try to answer them, at least from my own perspective. The first one is a question that they're all questions that we hear today, but the first one is one that we've heard recently, and that is international terrorism the major threat of the 21st century, or is international terrorism the major threat that the United States faces today? My answer to that question, if we just take it as international terrorism, is no. It's not the major threat that we face today. What makes it a significant threat, what makes it something that we have to pay attention to, is if you marry that threat of terrorist bombs in places around the world with, one, weapons of mass destruction. And to some degree, you can say that an airplane filled with petroleum, with gasoline driven into a skyscraper in New York, is an unconventional form of a weapon of mass destruction. But my point here is the mass casualty situation that a weapon of mass destruction can produce is what makes the terrorist threat more significant and one that we need to pay attention to. The second one is if the terrorists can speak for a much broader segment of the world than their numbers, in fact, represent. Can they speak, therefore, for the majority of the Muslim world? If they have weapons of mass destruction and if they can speak for that large segment of the globe, then they represent the most significant threat that we're going to face today. But having divided this up into those points, it becomes, I think, more clear what we need to be thinking about and what we need to be focusing our attention on, which is preventing the weapons of mass destruction from falling into the hands of terrorists and preventing the terrorists from an ability to speak for broad segments of the Islamic world, which means that while we may have to use force in some situations, the principal tools, the principal efforts are going to have to use politics and diplomacy and working with other people around the world rather than kicking in doors, and I don't mean to diminish their value, by themselves. So I think that the point that I have to start with first is, while it may be important to think about the military or the intelligence or the law enforcement aspect of this struggle, I think it is more important to think about the political aspects of this struggle and to make sure that we're attending to them. That leads me to the second question, which I think the answer to is obvious, but it hasn't always been the policy that we've pursued, and that is, are friends and allies critical to this struggle? I have felt and continue to feel that that's the case. I felt on the day and week and month after 9/11 that something truly significant had happened when the United Nations and NATO and other international bodies and countries rallied to the support of the United States. The UN passed a resolution which, for the first time in its history, ignored a fight over what terrorism actually was in order to express support for the United States. We had, in fact, assembled and support the largest coalition that had ever focused on a single problem in the world. Unfortunately, that feeling of support, that degree of assistance, has sadly dissipated, and sadly, I believe it is a result primarily of our entry into Iraq, and if not the mere fact of our entry, the way in which we chose to enter Iraq by failing to assemble the kind of coalition that was available for the first Gulf War, by failing to ensure that we, in fact, had the legitimacy of the United Nations behind us, and that we had Arab support and participation. I think all of those factors together came together to undermine that level of support that we had. regardless of the mistakes that we made, and Flint is absolutely right in talking about what we didn't do in Afghanistan when we had the opportunity to. Now we find ourselves in the Muslim world having very little traction for other kinds of policies that we might wish to pursue. And we find ourselves without the broader base of international support that we had after 9/11 and that we have generally had as we have pursued common objectives in the world to undertake some of the more difficult challenges and tasks that we face in the way ahead. Our image, as Andrew has indicated, in the Muslim world and in the world at large has been diminished and may, at least in the Muslim world, be at the lowest level that's ever been in history. At the very time we need others to stand with us in order to overcome the deficit position we found ourselves in as a result of where we are in Iraq today. So it seems to me that if we are to move forward, we're going to have to find a way to move forward together with others in a way that allows others to speak loudly as well to overcome the reaction, particularly the reaction in the Muslim world that we face. The third question is democracy the strategy that we should be using to separate or delegitimize Osama bin Laden and his movement from the Muslim world? I think Flynn has already spoken to this, but I just want to add a few other points, and that is, while democracy may be a valuable tool and a valuable strategy, it's certainly not a silver bullet, and it is certainly not something that we can move precipitously to support when the most organized and attuned forces in most of the Muslim world are religious forces with some fundamentalist relationship, as they have provided social services, as they have overcome the webs of corruption that exist in many of the secular governments that exist in the Muslim world today. So it seems to me that we need to be stepping back, not to walk away from democracy as an objective or a long-term goal, but to recognize that we're going to have to take some important steps the interim, like building more responsive and stronger institutions both within governments and within civil society, ensuring that corruption is at least reduced, if not eliminated, that education becomes a opportunity for individuals in these societies, that there is an economic opportunity as well, and that tolerance and human rights become a basis for public dialogue with some sensitivity toward the religious and cultural sensitivities of these countries. In appreciation today that the nationalist and secular leaders of much of the Muslim world are now viewed as failures, and that we are going to have to find a way to transition, but a way in which that transition doesn't end up with worse situations coming about than the situations we look to leave behind. The last question I want to ask is Iraq, the central front in the war on terrorism. And there, I simply say no, and I say so with all of the conviction of having watched this tragedy unfold. It wasn't in the beginning. Flint and I sat in the NSC. We read the intelligence. There was not a terrorist threat in Iraq. They had supported terrorism in the past, Palestinian terrorism. There was a fundamentalist group called Ansar al-Islam within Iraqi territory. It was in the Kurdish section. It was on the border with Iran. And there may have been some transits through Baghdad to get there, but they were a marriage of convenience for Saddam. They were the enemy of the secular Kurds, and therefore they were a group that Baghdad could at least tolerate. they weren't a particularly strong international group. They were useful, but they were not the kind of relationship that meant that Saddam was a terrorist threat. And we are not involved in a terrorist struggle with international terrorism in Iraq today. We are sitting on top of a sectarian civil war, and I don't know any other way to describe that situation. If you want to call it an insurgency, well, then it's an insurgency between Sunnis and a Shia-dominated government. International terrorists are there. They have been there. They have never been prominent in their numbers in Iraq. They have used some tactics. But in asymmetric warfare of almost any form, terrorism is a tactic that particularly the weaker side chooses to use. That does not necessarily point to this being the central front in the war against international terrorism. Does Iraq matter to the war on terrorism? I think the answer to that, however, is yes. I think Bob Pape pointed out the fact that our military presence there has some effect on the ability of terrorists in general to recruit and to propagandize their message around the world. I think that it is certainly an opportunity for Americans and Westerners to be killed, whether it's by international terrorists or by the adherence to the Civil War, and that represents a propaganda opportunity. It represents a possibility for developing tactics and training for international terrorists. And it is true that our withdrawal, particularly our precipitous withdrawal from Iraq, would represent what would be declared at a minimum as a propaganda victory on the part of terrorists, which makes the challenge of the way ahead in Iraq today an enormous challenge in finding the balance on how to make it less of a problem for us in the war on terrorism and not more of a problem for us in the war on terrorism. But we're here to talk about terrorism and not Iraq, so I'll stop there on that. Mm-hmm. And end finally with simply a point, and that is that the message matters. We heard a speech recently, by the president, in which he quoted from bin Laden, from Zawahiri, from Ahmadinejad, and others about the messianic missions that they had all adopted for themselves, and why those messages represented a enduring challenge to the United States and to the Western world if we were to walk away from them and not deal with them. I think that there is a value in talking about that, but I also have to say that this is an issue which cuts both ways, and what we say, just as what we do, will come back to haunt us if those words are as ill-chosen and misused as the words of mission that bin Laden and Zawahiri and Ahmadinejad and others have used to rally their troops for domestic purposes when we all know that speaking at home and speaking abroad are the same thing these days in a world in which message is distributed at the speed of light to everyone around the world. Let me stop there and look forward to the questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Randy. Bob, I have some questions. Do you want to say anything else in addition to your presentation, or because I have some questions that may lead in that direction. I also want to give time for the audience Q&A.
Sure. I'm glad to go right to questions.
I had one question that's been in my mind, and a couple people have touched on it, but I think this is mainly for Andy Kohut, and others may want to jump in. But you mentioned, Andy, that there's clearly disillusionment with Iraq, and U.S. attitudes towards American foreign policy have clearly declined, or popularity of U.S. foreign policy declined, clearly tied to Iraq. It's much harder than the American public was led to believe. It's much more costly. It's taken much longer. But is there also a rising sense that it's worse than just hard, but it's actually counterproductive in the sense that Flint and Bob in particular have pointed out? And the reason I ask this question is because among foreign policy theorists and IR theorists that this has actually been pretty well understood for some time, that it was the possession of power that that contributed to us being a target for terrorism. In fact, Bob Kagan in Paradise and Power said specifically that in so many words, that it was our power that made us the target and sometimes often the only target of terrorism. Or a bit more colorfully, he compared us and the Europeans, that we were the sheriff and the Europeans were the saloon keepers, and outlaws shoot sheriffs, not saloon keepers, in a typically colorful fashion. Is that sense, again, a sense among foreign policy theorists, like, yes, this is a cost of being the world's hegemon, but we must bear these costs, is the way that Kagan put it forward. Is this filtering down to the public? Do they understand the counterproductive nature or the potential for the exercise of power being counterproductive in the fight?
I think they understand that Iraq is not working. I think that their sense of comfort that Iraq would make the war on terrorism a success, they're just disabused of that notion. There would have never been support for the war in Iraq, going into Iraq, if we hadn't had the September 11th attacks. And if you will recall, even after we did not find weapons of mass destruction, there was no change of heart about Iraq. Iraq only changed when it was seen as not going well and not producing the desired effect. Let me address this just a little bit further. Internationally, the issue of our policies are the real driver of discontent with the United States, but resentment and suspicion of our power is feeds on this resentment of our policies complicates the resentment of our power and suspicion about our power. There's an interplay between the two. It's not just policies and it's not just power, but the two play off each other. I'd like to address something that you said, and that is the question of whether the terrorist would speak for a broader constituency. There's a really complicated answer to that question. Over the past 5 years, we've been doing surveys in Muslim countries, and what we've found is that dislike, if not hatred, of the United States after Iraq and coincident with the war on terrorism has gone straight up. But support for terrorism has actually decreased in most places. It's decreased in places, notably, that have had their own bad experience with terrorism. Pakistan, Jordan, Morocco, Indonesia, even Turkey. In those places, the support for terrorism is going down. So the two issues, dislike of the United States and support for terrorism, go on separate tracks. The problem with the decline in the support for terrorism is that support for terrorism remains so high in absolute terms in Muslim countries and even among Muslim publics in Europe, that the small numbers, the small residual numbers, for example, in Britain, I think the numbers that we had this spring was something like 8 or 9%, or maybe it was 10%, saying that they thought suicide bombing was justifiable. That's a half or a third of what we find in Muslim countries. But 10% of the British public saying that suicide bombing is justifiable, or thinking that Osama bin Laden represents, you know, the right way to do things. It's a very complicated issue when you get to this question about what is the impact of terrorism on public opinion in the Muslim world.
If I can, I will entertain questions from the audience and then may exercise my chair's prerogative to insert a question of my own. But we have until 12:15 today, and I would ask that you wait for the microphone, identify yourself, and please keep your question short. If it is to a particular panelist, please let us know, or otherwise you can open it up. And I will recognize, in the back row there, right there.
With the Minaret of Freedom Institute. My question is to Professor Pape, and let me preface it by saying, as a former physical scientist who went into the social scientists, I compliment you as someone who deserves the word scientist added to his name. However, much as I liked your presentation, I wanted to ask you on your proposal of what to do about it, namely the offshore balancing. You indicated that a critical element of its success would be alliances with countries in the area. Is this going to be that easy to do, for example, vis-a-vis Iraq? How is it possible to form an alliance with an Iraqi government without actually installing the Iraqi government we want to form the alliance with, given what's happened recently?
My view on one of the key problems we've had in building the Iraqi government is that we've boxed up the building of the Iraqi army. The reason is not because we haven't thrown enough money at it. The reason is because precisely this idea we've had where we embedded our lieutenant colonels all the way through the brigade structure and the command structure of the Iraqi army, what this is doing is creating a contradiction in loyalties. So just imagine, if you would, if you're an Iraqi soldier and what's happening in your unit is, yes, there are some Iraqi officers, but ultimately who's directing that unit is an American lieutenant colonel or colonel. Well, who is the officer of your unit then loyal to? It's really not loyal to the Iraqi government. It's loyal to George Bush. In fact, we wouldn't have it any other way. We're not going to put our soldiers in there and have them be loyal to the Iraqi government. So as a result, what's happened over the last few years, whether it's General Petraeus, who's one of the most excellent officers we've had in the U.S. military, whoever we've put in, and precisely because we've tried to build the Iraqi army this way, what's happened is it's we've been able to create a few brigades, but what's ultimately the case is we don't have reliable Iraqi troops that will fight for the Iraqi government. And so the fundamental fact is that what we need to do over the next year, and we should have done this a year ago, but this will take at least a year, is we need to actually transfer responsibility for the control of the Iraqi army to the Iraqi government. In the course of doing that, the American troops can play a very important role in Iraq, but it's not the role they're currently playing. The role that we've been playing by sitting in Anbar province is actually just simply creating more and more problems. What we should be doing, and actually General Casey is starting to do this, is we should have been deploying our troops along the lines of contact of the three communities, much the way we did in Bosnia in the mid-1990s. You might remember that we had this enormous problem in Bosnia, many people saying, just can't be stopped, ancient hatreds, et cetera, et cetera. And then when we finally got serious and we deployed our troops, NATO's troops, along the lines of contact of the three communities, this really had a rather substantially calming presence. And I don't mean to say that we could fully reproduce that in the case of Iraq, but if we would just simply concentrate our forces in Baghdad and Kirkuk to keep at least a lid on the violence that's there, this in combination with letting the Iraqi army actually form under the Iraqi government would be quite helpful over, say, a 3 or 4 year period.
Thank you. Down here, Mike.
Mike Miyazawa, I have a couple of questions. Mr. Pape, during your presentation, you did not talk about the Palestinian suicide bombing. And most of the people from the Middle East say the Israeli occupation is the root cause of all the attacks against the United States. My question is, have you done any survey about this point? And if yes, what were your findings? Another question for Ms. Priest.
Okay, Mike, hold on just a second. Let's let Bob answer that, and then you can ask the question to...
I'd be glad to talk for hours about this subject. Yes, large parts of the book are devoted to this. In fact, it's not simply the military presence of the IDF on the West Bank and Gaza, but if you wanted to get a picture of the trajectory of the violence from the first intifada all the way through to the second intifada, the best way to do that is simply to track the number of settlers going into the West Bank. You see, although Israel's had the West Bank since 1967, if you actually look year by year, and this is what I do in the book, at the number of settlers going into the West Bank, they don't begin to go in large numbers until the mid to late 1980s, right at the point. In fact, if you see these trajectories build up, you can see immediately that this is very likely to provoke some resistance on the part of Palestinians. And then if you just simply look at this look at the graphs of the settlers, you can also see why the Oslo Accords would at first seem to offer some hope. And then, in fact, quickly Palestinians might become disabused of this, because after 7 years of Oslo, the number of settlers doubles. in just 7 years, from about 100,000 to 200,000. Well, you can see why you might not think Oslo is actually doing much good if the number is doubling into that. And anyway, it could go on and on. But
and Ms. Priest, you withheld the names of five Eastern European countries where the CIA set up the black sites. And many sources, including European Parliament, have referred to the names of two countries, Romania and Poland. Could you tell us the names of the three other...
Nice try.
No. And we never said five, we said several. But I'd like to tell you... But I'd like to tell you why. Because I, as a journalist, it's one of the most uncomfortable things, and yet I agree with our decision not to do that. And we revisited it after the president made his speech. We had people in our newsroom saying, well... And to me, I said, well, what? And this is the reason that those countries all participate in other ways with the CIA and other intelligence areas that are not controversial. I don't think they would be controversial if they were known, and that are very helpful. And when I, you know, discovered what some of them were, I was, you know, I thought, wow, that's really, really interesting. And, of course, as a journalist, my knee-jerk reaction was, well, that's a positive thing. Let's just talk about it. And then when you, or let me print it. And then when I thought for a second more about what that would mean that some of those things would end. Because, and I've tried to figure out an analogy that wouldn't be controversial. So here's my analogy. If during World War II Hitler had a driver who was Haitian, and he had, I'm trying to be so neutral that no one can say, you know, and was a trusted confidant because he went everywhere with him, and he happened to also be an agent of someone's, and through there to us, and gave us valuable information, and someone wrote about the tight cooperation of the Haitians with the Americans, don't you think Hitler would say, you know, have second thoughts now about the Haitian who's his driver, and he never thought about it. So there are things that are happening that I, again, don't think are controversial, and that they're positive, and they're giving, they're making positive contributions to what we know about other countries and how we can act against suspected terrorists, that even I, as a person who believes very strongly in disclosing as much as I can definitely agree should not be publicized.
Sir, right there.
I'm a London parliamentarian, a defence spokesman for the Conservative Party, though I'm here in a personal capacity. I've read your book, Dr. Pape. I think it's outstanding, both in terms of the data it contains and in the clarity with which you put your case. What I'm concerned about is the conclusions for subsequent action that might be drawn from it, and I'm not entirely sure that you dealt fully enough or adequately enough with the first question that you were asked today. It may well be the case that suicide terrorism increases when there is foreign occupation, but sometimes there are burdens that have to be borne. If, for example, we drew the conclusion that had the IRA resorted to suicide terrorism, we should therefore have withdrawn from Northern Ireland, despite the wishes of the majority of the people in Northern Ireland, would that have been the correct conclusion? Now, what it seems to me you're saying is that you can have the best of both worlds. You can minimize the suicide terrorism by going offshore in the way you've described it. But are you sure that an offshore strategy will enable the United States to prevent the takeover of countries by fundamentalist or other extremist regimes that will be immensely harmful? Would, for example, such a strategy apply in Afghanistan? And is it really that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda simply want to liberate their own lands from occupation, or is it that they have wider ambitions for which driving out America is only the first step?
Thank you. Well, you're quite right that I'm only getting an opportunity to develop parts of this, and so I guess maybe the best way is just to come right at Afghanistan. You have a lot of things to in your question, and if there's more, then perhaps someone else in the audience could pick it up. But in the case of Afghanistan, if the we first have to know, what is our purpose in being in Afghanistan? Well, the original purpose was to get, not to topple the Taliban, that was a lesser included. The original purpose was Al-Qaeda, as we've heard from two different people who were there, we deliberately put that aside. Now, perhaps there were good reasons to do that. Myself, I'm quite skeptical. Myself, I think the original purpose was a good purpose. I could explain why I still think that's at least a reasonably good purpose, even if it wouldn't fully end the threat. But the fact is, I don't think we're having that discussion right now. What I think we're discussing is whether or not we should be propping up Karzai, because if he were to fall, this would look awfully embarrassing since we invited him to a State of the Union. and I think that if that's really the purpose, that's a secondary purpose, and it should be one that we work directly with the Pashtuns. If we look at what's threatening Karzai, it is on the surface suicide attacks that are coming at the government and Western forces. But underneath that is support by the ISI and through the Pashtuns for undermining Karzai's government. Well, if we want to think about this seriously, then I think I would just simply suggest what we do is we work directly with the Pashtuns in sort of a more direct fashion. And if, in fact, that leads to a new leader coming into Kabul that is more sort of, we should say, convenient for the Pashtuns, then perhaps we support that. But what we should be doing, as in the case of Iraq, in Iraq, we do need to work with the Shia. They're the central power in Iraq. Doesn't mean we give them anything they want, but we do have to work with them. In the case of Afghanistan, we should be working directly with the Pashtuns, and I don't see us really doing that at the moment. In fact, if you look at the most recent information coming out of Afghanistan, we're losing support from the Pashtun population rather dramatically over the last few months.
Flint or Randy, do you have anything to add to that?
No.
Okay. That's also a fair response. Down here, and then we'll get some folks in the back. Right here.
My question is to Flint. You spoke about a policy of enhancing moderates and weakening radicals. What policy should the U.S. adopt to empower moderates, destroy the radicals, and also enhance free market forces, so you can create wealth and prosperity?
Okay, thank you. That's a man. I almost plant that question. I think in order to recover the U.S. position in the Middle East and in the war on terror, we have to do a set of things. In terms of Iraq, I think Randy is exactly right. We are already in a situation of communal civil war in Iraq. And at this point, our options are either to continue down a feckless and counterproductive course, which could end up with Iraq looking more or less like Somalia, but with a lot more strategic consequences, or you essentially try to bring about some kind of power-sharing arrangement among the different communal groups, try and encourage consolidation of authority within the major communal groups, and then work to effect some kind of power-sharing arrangement so that maybe in the end Iraq could end up looking sort of like Bosnia. Those are your options right now. And if you're going to go for the Bosnia option, it means you're going to have to engage other states, especially Iraq's neighbors, who have various kinds of ties and influence with the different communal groups, in the process of brokering those power-sharing arrangements. This administration has basically not been willing to consider a serious regional strategy for trying to manage Iraq and contain the negative consequences from what is basically our strategic failure there. I think that's one thing we have to undertake. Secondly, I think we have to get serious about diplomatic engagement with both Iran and Syria. I think Syria is eager for an improved strategic relationship with the United States. I think that this is something that we could do fairly readily and make real strategic gains by doing it, but we would have to be prepared to spell out for the Syrians, if they were to become more cooperative, what are the strategic benefits they would get from us? And this is something that, again, the administration has as a matter of policy, declined to do. And I think it's time to get serious about that. On Iran, we've seen a tactical shift in policy. We're now sort of willing, under the right conditions, to sit in multilateral talks on Iran's nuclear activities. But even if we manage to get into those talks, you know, that's not going to solve the bigger strategic problem with Iran. I've written extensively elsewhere why I think this, but, you know, the bottom line is, I think unless we're prepared to do a grand bargain with Iran and prepared to try and resolve all the outstanding bilateral differences between the United States and the Islamic Republic in a package, we're not going to get anywhere there, and I think it's time to do it. We had the chance to start doing it 3 years ago when Iran wasn't enriching uranium or spinning centrifuges. The price of doing it is only going to get higher the longer we delay it. Another thing we need to do is get serious about the Palestinian issue. I think it's time to lay out an American vision for final status, parameters for resolving the key final status issues in ways that would meet the minimum needs of both sides. I don't think the intellectual content of those parameters is any mystery. But we have been unwilling to do that, basically because I think in the end, the most powerful players in this administration don't believe in those parameters and think that they can somehow push this issue off far enough that you'll get a Palestinian leadership that at some point is prepared to accept less than what was on the table at Taba. And I don't think that's going to happen. And the longer we delay getting on the right side of that issue, the further damage it's going to do to our position. I think we also have to take seriously the Saudi peace initiative that the Arab League endorsed and you know, aim not just at a two-state solution to the Palestinian conflict, but you know, have an agenda that aims at comprehensive Arab-Israeli peace, building on the Saudi peace initiative. I've already said why I think democratization is a bad idea, and I think we really ought to, you know, drop that as a focus, pay attention to economic reform, pay attention to human rights. You know, don't worry about elections in most of these countries anytime soon. And then I think it's long overdue for this strategically critical part of the world that we start to develop a regional security framework, a kind of OSCE-like mechanism for the Middle East, involving all of the regional states, including those that we don't like particularly well, and including us along with other major external players. At this point, I think it'd probably be important to include China. For example, as part of a regional security framework, along with traditional international partners like the Europeans. That's kind of the agenda I would lay out for you know, trying to recover the American position in the Middle East and the war on terror.
Could I just add?
Please go ahead.
A couple of things. The only two things that I would add, and I agree with what Flint said. The Arab Human Development Report talked about the value of education in the Muslim world, and I think that that's true. But if you only do the education part, you'll still end up with the problem. And Flint said economic opportunity is got to go hand in hand with that. But the second thing that has to go hand in hand with that is the combination of strengthening institutions and dealing with the corruption issue. And that can only come as an international process. It's certainly not something we can direct and offer as our gold-coated solution to these problems. It has to be something along the lines of the International Corruption on Convention, which sets some parameters on how to deal with corruption on a global basis and a way in which to approach all governments on issues such as these in order to allow the real economic opportunity to have an opportunity to move forward.
Okay. I want to get a few people in the back, and if I have time, I'll get back to the front. There was a hand in the way back there. Go ahead, right there.
I am Richard Youngflesh from the Northern Virginia Community College. I've heard reports now that the international terrorist threat is much less centrally directed than we thought. That Al Qaeda has these kind of cells that don't take direction or necessarily take direction from that. The incident in New York City where they thwarted some threat, and they had the tip-off from the Islamic community within the city itself. So it's much more of a policing action than we originally thought as well. Would you agree with that, that we should put more emphasis on the policing part of it rather than the military?
Well, let me break your question into two parts. First, this whole issue, which has really actually been something, by the way, I've seen in Washington, which is this, is Al-Qaeda hierarchical or is it decentralized? I think that this is actually kind of missing what Al-Qaeda is. I think that if you thought Al-Qaeda was a religious cult, this would be a perfectly reasonable way to think about it. However, from the beginning, Al-Qaeda has really been a movement. It's been a broad movement. It's been a movement, and I'll just use an analogy. It's not exactly like it, but if you think of the civil rights movement in the 1960s, there's Martin Luther King with peace marches, there's Malcolm X, there's the Black Panthers, there's the Weathermen. Now, some of this movement is hierarchical, but Martin Luther King is not directing Malcolm X, much less the Black Panthers. So there's quite a bit of this movement, which is, in fact, just simply coherent around an idea, not an individual person. That's very much what's happening with Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is a movement that is in strong opposition to the presence of Western combat forces on the Arabian Peninsula, and then secondarily in other Muslim countries, and then I would say thirdly also power behind the throne, American foreign policy behind the throne, supporting repressive regimes. That manifests itself in the actual attacks in a couple of ways. First of all, what we see is that some attacks are actually quite, there's a lot of lines of communication between Al-Qaeda and the attackers. I could trace out for you the leader-to-leader, Al-Qaeda to JI links, for instance, in the Indonesia attacks in great detail. Also, the money flows. I could also compare for you something that's not typically compared, which are the connections, the way the operation on 9/11 was assembled compared to the way the 7/7 July bombers in London were assembled. They're often described as very different. That made sense when we knew less about the 7/7 plot and how it was put together. You see, the 7/7 attackers, two of them, much the way Atta did, Atta went to meet Osama, much the way several of the 7/7 attackers went to Pakistan, and we now really quite assume to go and meet directly with, if not Osama and al-Zawahiri, at least some al-Qaeda leaders. And then when Atta came and actually ran his operation in the United States, he had some contact with Osama. There were several phone calls that we now have at least released in the 9/11 report between Atta and Osama occurring over the summer of 2001, which, by the way, are quite similar to the phone calls that were made between the 7/7 bombers and Pakistan both 2 weeks before the 7/7 bombing and several months before. So what does that add up to? That adds up to me that most of Al-Qaeda's attacks, there are some connections directly with the attackers and the leaders. Many there are not, but the fact is that we should be expecting this kind of variation within a movement where what's holding this together is not fighting for a man, Osama, it's fighting for an idea.
Thank you. There was another questioner right there. Yes.
amongst the U.S. allies do you expect such an attack to take place? What would your guess be? And the second part of the question is, you look at suicide bombings at places where there has been military occupation and how the terrorists have emanated from these places, especially suicide attacks. But what about the places where there has been occupation for long periods of time, especially in the Pacific theater, like Japan and Korea, and there has been no suicide terrorism there? And there is a lot of resentment against U.S. occupation, but still, it hasn't happened. So how would you explain that? And lastly,
That's good. Thank you.
The second question actually consumes about 100 pages of the book. So there's a whole set of secondary causes. Some of them are quite interesting. The key issue, why some occupations escalate to suicide terrorism and not others over the last 20 years, is that there's the main secondary enabling factor has been a religious difference between the foreign occupying forces and the local community. Even though, I don't mean that some religions do this and not others, I mean that when you have a religious difference, even in purely secular conflicts, such as in Sri Lanka, where the Tamils are Hindus and the Sinhalese are Buddhists, when there's a religious difference, this enables the terrorist leader to paint the occupier as driven by a religious agenda. And that can scare the bejesus out of members of the local community who are both religious and secular. Because even if you're secular and you're not part of your own religion, well, that doesn't mean you want to be part of the occupier's agenda, so to speak. This is why the idea of the crusader image plays such a big role in Al-Qaeda's recruitment messages. You only saw a few words of it by Adam Gadon, but if you saw Osama's speeches, you would see he talks a lot about religion. He's talking about religion in the context of what's motivating the American occupation of the Arabian Peninsula as being driven by a religious, that is a crusader, that is a Christian agenda to convert Muslims, damage Islam, or help Israel expand so that Christians and Jews together can more easily or hold on to Jerusalem for a longer period of time. So anyway, there's just a short précis, about 100 pages that's in the book, and there's a lot of attention paid directly to that. In terms of your first question, I'm not trying to pretend that that my theory can give you point predictions. However, it is important to pay attention to simply what Al-Qaeda's pattern and trajectory of attacks tells us. The fact that Osama has took us off the list, so to speak, for several years, and now is deliberately calling on attacks directly against Americans. And if you look at this is really quite worrisome. So I think I'm much more concerned about an attack in the short term and medium term in the United States. And by the way, this talk I gave, I was giving it to the most senior levels of the FBI, the heads of the national field offices, sitting in a room just like you, who had come together at West Point for a special meeting, about 80 of them, from all different parts of the country, the day before, August 9th, the day before the August 10th plot was announced. And I was specifically concerned that something like that might appear. So there's more to say on that regard, but I don't mean to. We can say the strategic trajectory of the attacks, but not really make point predictions.
Dana had a question.
Well, I can't help it because this is what I usually do. But you know,
and I'm sure so it's going to be a good.
You were you eloquently stated that what's holding this together is fighting for a movement, not a man. So give me your assessment of how important it is to capture UBL and what will it matter.
It doesn't. I don't think it matters because UBL is inspirational. Although he is quite an inspirational figure, he's sort of the Bill Clinton of Al Qaeda. I mean, he's really he really is.
Don't quote him on that.
He really is. He really is an inspirational figure. But the fact of the matter is, as we saw with Zarqawi, Zarqawi went from being somebody nobody knew the name of to suddenly everybody knew the name of, simply with the American invasion of Iraq. So this can be an inspirational figure can be created when necessary. The reason Osama is worrisome is simply because of his skill.
One of the things that's quite worrisome, when you read the Norwegian document, I've spent, before doing terrorism, I spent 15 years doing air power, and what air power is all about is coercion. I wasn't teaching people in the Air Force how to put a bomb on a target. It was all about arguments about what would coerce, not coerce, what would be counterproductive. One of the things that's very worrisome about Osama is just how seriously these documents take into account the possibility of backlash. They're really quite sophisticated. Osama has now been at this over 20 years, and he hasn't yet shot himself in the foot. Now, if you think about Milosevic, it didn't take Milosevic very long to shoot himself in the foot. If you look at Saddam has actually shot himself in the foot multiple times, helping us out in ways, countless numbers of ways. I'm afraid the real issue here with Osama and al-Zahari is not so much their inspirational value, which is, of course, you know, salient. I don't mean to undermine it completely, but the fact is they're simply better. They're simply good adversaries, and it'd be nice to have out of the way. Zarqawi is more the kind of guy we'd like to have. He'll, you know, where somebody would, you know, be popular for a year or two, eventually overstep and get turned in by his own people. Well, that's what we'd like to be up against, the Zarqawis of the world, not Osama and al-Zahari, who are just simply better than the average opponent we've been up against.
So finding them is still an important issue for you.
It's a useful medium term simply because it takes away some of the best operational commanders al-Qaeda has. This is a bit like looking at the operational skills of our American military. I mean, we have some excellent operational commanders, and we should just recognize that they're really valuable in these operations. And in al-Qaeda's operations, their purpose is not to die, it's to kill large numbers of people. So there's a fair bit of operational substance here that we would like to undermine.
We only have a little bit of time. Flint or Randy, do you want to weigh in on that as well? What do you think about how important is it to capture Osama?
First of all, I think the key point is it's both of them.
Right.
We don't know which one of them is the real bin Laden.
Yeah. Right. right.
So, yeah. Because we don't, it's both of them. Secondly, there will be, in any case, and this is one of the beauties of their operation, there will be a downside even if they are captured or killed, because they will then become even greater myths in death than they will be alive. And so we are going to have to accept that. But I would still go with where Bob left it, which is we're better off with their operational skills being taken, their propaganda skills being taken off the table, than leaving them out there.
All right. Well, with that, I have to wrap things up. I want to again thank the panelists for a terrific discussion today. Very important on a very important subject. I want to thank all of you for coming out. We had some competition today, and yet we still managed to fill the room, and I appreciate that very much. And please join me in giving a round of applause to our panelists who took some time out of their busy day. Thank you.